A Parmigiano Reggiano wheel, aged 36 months, contains roughly 1,200 milligrams of free glutamate per 100 grams of cheese, which is among the highest concentrations of free glutamate in any food on Earth. The cooks who built classical Italian cuisine had no name for what made aged Parmigiano taste the way it does. They knew it was different from young cheese. They knew it transformed a bowl of pasta the moment it was grated over the top. They knew, without articulating it, that a long-aged hard cheese added a quality to a dish that no other ingredient supplied. What they did not know was that a chemist in Tokyo would, in 1908, isolate the molecule responsible and give it a name in a language none of them spoke. 94 years would then pass before Western science formally agreed that the molecule corresponded to a real taste with a real receptor on the real human tongue. Across that 94-year gap, cooks worldwide used the effect without being permitted to name it. What changed when the naming finally happened tells us most of what we need to know about modern restaurant cooking and about what cooking is, structurally, in the 21st century. The mechanism is by now well established, and I have written about its long suppression at greater length in the fifth taste science refused to accept. The compressed version is that Kikune Ikeda at the Imperial University of Tokyo identified monosodium glutamate as the active compound in kanbu dashi in 1908. Subsequent work identified inosinate, Kodama, 1913, and guanylate, Kuninaka, 1957, as synergistic compounds that multiply perceived umami intensity by a factor of 7 or 8 when combined with glutamate. Charles Zucker and Nicholas Riba at UC San Diego identified the T1R1-T1R3 taste receptor complex on the human tongue in 2002, providing the formal mechanistic confirmation that Western taste science had been waiting for. Umami was upgraded from a Japanese culinary concept to a basic taste in the textbooks. 94 years after Ikeda's paper, the framework of sweet, sour, bitter, salty officially became sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami. What is more interesting than the timeline itself is what cooks did before the timeline closed. The pre-1908 history of Western cooking is on close inspection a 5,000-year-long project of producing high glutamate ingredients without naming the principle that made them powerful. Roman garum was a fermented fish sauce produced in industrial quantities across the Mediterranean, with glutamate concentrations in the 8 to 1500 mg per 100 grams range, comparable to soy sauce, which it functionally was. Aged Parmigiano, aged Comté, aged Manchego. Each tradition arrived independently at the discovery that long aging of hard cheese liberates free glutamate from milk proteins through gradual enzymatic breakdown. Dried mushrooms, slow-cooked meat stocks, sun-dried tomatoes, anchovy pastes, miso, soy sauce, fish sauce, ripe tomatoes themselves. All of these are concentrations of the same molecule, arrived at through fermentation, aging, drying, or slow reduction. The cuisines of the world had, by the early 20th century, an extensive and entirely empirical mastery of the technologies for producing umami. They could make it. They could not name it. The naming was not necessary for the making. What the naming changed, when it finally arrived in the chef vocabulary in the late 20th century, was the cook's relationship to the effect. A chef who has read about glutamate IMP synergy can reach deliberately for the combination. Kombu and katsuobushi in a dashi, tomato and anchovy in a Mediterranean sauce, soy and dried mushroom in a stock, and do consciously what the tradition had done by accident. Heston Blumenthal, working through his fat duck kitchen in the late 1990s and early 2000s, made the synergistic combination of glutamate-rich and inosinate-rich ingredients an explicit part of his menu design, building dishes around documented combinations rather than inherited ones. Ferran Adrià et El Bulli used the same vocabulary in his deconstructions of classical dishes, often substituting a single high glutamate technical preparation, a powdered concentrate of dried tomato, a clarified ham stock, for the longer traditional process that had produced the same effect through aging. David Chang, building Momofuku in New York in the late 2000s, made glutamate-forward cooking a central aesthetic, openly using ingredients like aged country ham, fermented bean pastes, and shellfish stocks for the umami they delivered, and arguing in interviews that the disavowal of MSG in American food culture was itself a piece of cultural prejudice. These three chefs are not isolated. They are the visible edge of a generation of cooks who, having received the vocabulary from Japanese food science, began to reach for the effect intentionally, rather than producing it as a byproduct of long technique. The structural consequence for modern restaurant cooking, the part that often goes unstated, is that contemporary fine dining has become structurally dependent on umami in ways the menus do not always acknowledge. The plate-by-plate intensity expected of a modern tasting menu, the immediate lingering mouth-filling depth that a guest expects from each of 12 to 20 small courses, is achievable across that many dishes only if every dish carries a substantial glutamate or IMP-GMP load. A kitchen that ignored umami would have to compensate with fat, salt, or sheer richness in every course, which the modern palate would reject after the third plate. Glutamate is the chemistry that allows the modern tasting menu to function at the cumulative intensity it does. The katsuobushi kanbu dashi is one of the more honest expressions of this. A 48-hour brown stock reduced to a quarter of its volume is another, functionally identical at the molecular level. A clarified ham consomme layered with dashi-cured tomatoes is a third. The kitchen technique varies. I have explored what the underlying principle does to traditional Asian cooking in What Would Happen If Romans Ate Modern Ramen. But the principle extends to every contemporary kitchen that aims for sustained intensity across many courses. The reason this dependence is not always acknowledged is the unresolved political residue of MSG. The Chinese Restaurant Syndrome Letter of 1968, a single physician's anecdote that entered the medical literature without controlled study, produced a 40-year cultural panic about added monosodium glutamate that subsequent controlled research has been unable to support. Tarasoff and Kelly's 1993 double-blind study in food and chemical toxicology found no consistent symptomatic response to MSG when subjects were blinded to what they had consumed. The FDA continues to classify MSG as generally recognized as safe. American supermarkets are nonetheless full of packaging that proudly bears no MSG labels. Sometimes on products that contain large quantities of free glutamate from other sources, like autolyzed yeast extract, hydrolyzed protein, or, yes, Parmesan cheese. The cultural memory of the panic has outlasted the science that should have ended it. Many modern restaurants therefore produce dishes that are structurally dependent on glutamate while quietly avoiding the word, sourcing the molecule from technically respectable ingredients. Kombu, aged cheese, slow stock, while declining to add a teaspoon of the powder that would deliver the same compound at a tenth the cost. The cooking is unchanged. The vocabulary is contorted to accommodate a cultural anxiety that no longer has a scientific basis. What umami reveals about modern cooking, then, is something both technical and cultural. Technically, it reveals that contemporary fine dining is built on a single molecule and its synergistic partners, and that any cook who wants to work at that level needs to think explicitly about how each dish delivers them. Culturally, it reveals that the path from sensory reality to scientific recognition to popular acceptance is shaped at every step by who is doing the naming, who is being credited, and whose cuisine is being treated as suspect. A Japanese chemist in 1908 had made a discovery that a French chef in 2026 still cannot always acknowledge by its proper chemical name on a menu, even while building a career around its effect. That is not a story about food. It is a story about how food knowledge moves between civilizations and what happens to it when the gatekeepers do not speak the language of the people who made the discovery. The molecule on the tongue is older than the vocabulary on the menu. The cooking always knew. The names took 94 years to catch up, and in some kitchens they are still catching up. A dish that does not name what is making it deep is not less delicious for the missing name, but a cook who knows the name has the diagnostic tool that lets them reach for the effect on purpose, rather than producing it by accident. And that diagnostic is, in the end, what the 94-year wait was for.